Listen.
Послушай.
Écoute.
Vamos. Quíte ください.
Escucha. MCO.
Listen.
MCO.
MCO.
Between the bars. Hi, my name is Yannick Dondelanger. Welcome again to Between the Bars, the podcast where music and life mingle in conversations with the people who shape and who are the Mahler Chamber Orchestra. In the beginning, there was a bunch of very talented young friends who were starting their own chamber orchestra. That would be us, the founders of the Mahler Chamber Orchestra. There was a titan of a father figure in classical music who helped us give birth and nurtured us in our early years. That would be the late and great Claudio Bardo. And there was a young man, barely 22 years of age, who was thrown along with the rest of us into this melting pot. That was a young conductor called Daniel Harding. Would he sink or swim? Would our raw talent gel into something longer than just a big bang? Had Claudio Bardo made the right call in supporting this giant blind date? Well, the rest, as they say, is history. And, much like a story from the pages of rock band history, we had our Bohemian Rhapsody, our Rocket Man moment. Just with Mozart and Beethoven instead. There is, I can tell you, something really intoxicating about being with an entire orchestra and conductor in their 20s on the cusp of sudden international stardom, doing their thing together like no one else can. Fast forward to now, and we may be all grown up, responsible, and self-governing, with many strings to our proud bow. But when that combo of Daniel and MCO meet, we will always be young together. I had the huge pleasure to have a chat with Daniel one sunny spring, or was it autumn morning in March, in Adelaide, Australia, where we were performing at the Adelaide Festival. He'd recently recovered from breaking his leg, something actually quite rare for a conductor, and was just celebrating having become a commercial pilot.
I'm an unemployed airline pilot. That's where I am now.
However, it was our chat around Mozart's Titanic last three symphonies that touched most my feelings and made some sense of what one goes through when performing this amazing man's music. Our voices may sound a little gravelly, but that's just from the marathon Mozart Trinity Symphonies concert we performed the night before. Followed, of course, by some letting your hair down. Rock and roll. So my guest today kind of grew up musically together with Mahler Chamber Orchestra, but then went on to a career building relationships with other ensembles, just as the MCO went on to build its own career and partnerships. But the two have always kept contact artistically and socially. Bit like adult siblings, we don't always have time to meet so often, but when we do, it's always special and it means a lot, I think, to both of us. You're Mahler Chamber Orchestra's conductor laureate, Daniel Harding. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
I've got a wish list in front of me of stuff I want to talk to you about. Mozart flying, the environment, making music in Japan. But first, we're here at the Adelaide Festival, kicking off a tour with the Mahler Chamber Orchestra that focuses on some of the greatest music from Viennese composers, Mozart, Schubert, Bruckner. You've got five symphonies in front of you. You probably have been quite jet-lagged. And you have a leg that was until recently in plaster. Can you tell us about the leg first?
The leg.
The leg.
That was my last tour, December last year. With the Orchestre Paris, we went to Japan. The orchestra arrived one day. I arrived a day later. I arrived late in the evening, flew up to Sapporo, had a good sleep, woke up in the morning, beautiful snow everywhere. I spoke to the musicians at breakfast and I said, you know, how did you enjoy your free day? I said, well, about 25 people went skiing. And I said, you're crazy. Here we are on a tour and you 25 people just jet lag, climbing up a mountain, skiing down. I said, is anybody injured? No, no, everyone's fine. I was like, well, you know, and I was thinking, goodness me. So then we have rehearsal. We came out of the hotel and there's a taxi. They said, oh, here's your taxi. And I said, I don't need a taxi. It's 200 meters across the park to walk to the concert house. It'd be great, a bit of fresh air. The cold will wake me up. I made 50 meters.
And then whoops.
Hit a patch of sheet ice, fell on my bum, and I watched my ankle go underneath my body.
Ouch.
And I thought, that doesn't look good. So the orchestra doctor was 25 meters behind me. He picked me up, put me on the bench, said, "You wait there, I'll go." And he went back to the hotel, got a wheelchair and something to strap around the ankle. He said, "You're going to have an x-ray. We'll have to see what's gone on." I said, "Yeah, I thought it was a bit of a fuss." I went to the hospital. They took a look. They did a scan. And I saw the doctor, the French doctor, discussing with the Japanese doctors and nodding their head. And I was like, "Okay, they're going to tell me. Take a couple of days, you know, take it easy." And they came back and they said, "Yeah, you've torn the ligament and what turned out to be a triple fracture of the ankle." So there I was. And they said, "Yeah, that'll be, you know, you can consider that's at least 6 weeks, 3 months to repair." And, you know, and then the...
Did you continue rehabilitation? The tour?
Yeah, I did the tour.
I mean, you're still in pain. I noticed in rehearsals.
Yeah. I mean, now I'm at the stage where it's pretty much healed and it's just a question of building some muscle and getting the flexibility back.
Are you aware of your conducting in a different way?
Well, it was really tricky at the beginning. So the first couple of concerts on that tour where I'm sitting on a stool with my leg in plaster, I have to say it was very hard for the orchestra. It was very hard for me to have any feeling of contact.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to get a feeling of rhythm. When you're not anchored to the floor, it's amazing how your rhythm goes to shot. When you're taking strong pain medication, it's amazing how your rhythm goes shot. And the orchestra had the feeling, you know, of course everyone understood what was going on, but they instinctively have the feeling that I'm kind of not really involved and I'm kind of tickling the music from afar. It was impossible for me to have the same physical engagement.
They're sympathetic. I mean,
absolutely. But it's not a question of will. It's just, conducting is such a physically engaged activity. Mm. And when you're not physically engaged, everybody senses it. It took me a couple of concerts to find a different way. And I think it took them a couple of concerts to find a way of getting used to. But in the end, the tour went very well. But I mean, that was 10, 12 days of
hell,
of real discomfort. And I could, I mean, it's something that took 1 second. And then more or less, it kind of dominated my life. I mean, it was a determining factor in how everything went in my life for 3-4 months. Yeah. And that's quite a big deal.
I guess your schedule's normal now.
Yeah.
As normal as it can be. We've got two programs. There's the three Last Symphonies of Mozart, Schubert 3, Bruckner 4. The three Last Symphonies of Mozart, because I wanted to ask you about those specifically because there's such a mystique around them. We know they were composed in the space of less than around 2 months, 1788, around 3 years before he died, even though he produced a lot afterwards. They were the Last Symphonies. That was the pinnacle of his symphonic production, and a lot of people say that was a massive point in the history of symphonic writing. What is the mystique behind them, doing them in the three in the same concert, sometimes not even with a break?
Of course, you'll hear any one of them played individually,
yeah,
but there's always been a tradition of playing them together, of seeing them as something connected. I mean, I was very heavily influenced by Nicolas Arnoncourt, who I heard rehearsing and performing these pieces a lot. And the first time I experienced that in 2006, he was doing the two intermissions thing of right, saying, okay, this is an enormous event. This is the, you know, kind of the high mass of the Mozart symphonies. And so you have the two intermissions, the two intervals, that no one symphony gets kind of squashed next to the other ones. It's three enormous statements.
It's almost like a three-act opera.
Yeah. Then, I don't know if other people have done it before, but I became aware of this idea then of saying, you know what, let's take it even further and do it as one kind of orchestral oratorio. Yeah. So it's absolutely, when I tried that, was absolutely under his influence. And saying that he was convinced that, in a sense, it's one big piece. But as you say, in kind of three acts. We talk a lot in the rehearsals about what the meaning is.
Yeah.
And there are some things which I think are quite, there's a scale from completely imaginary through to pretty concrete in right, terms of what we think the significance behind the thing is. And so I'm always up for images and ideas and stories that help bring the thing alive. And I think these are incredibly dramatic pieces and nothing for me, does less justice to them than just ironing everything out and making them as kind of flat and pretty as possible. Mm. But I'm not saying that every image I give to the orchestra is based in any kind of fact.
It's based, no.
But, you know, this thing that the G minor was concretely the key that represented death.
Yes.
That's very, very important in this trilogy. And that the G minor symphony, which is so well known and so loved, it's such a great risk that is a kind of homecoming for people. Yeah. That the symphony begins and everybody relaxes and sits back in their chair and say, oh, you know, isn't this wonderful civilized music? And actually, this is the most agitated, terrifying kind of edge of the abyss music. And I think really finding that and doing justice to that is very important. And this thing that you come to the end of the G minor symphony, and again, that last chord where you feel as if you're staring into the grave. Mm. And however exhausted you are as a listener or as a performer, then this need for the C major symphony, which brings you back from the edge. And the C major symphony, a symphony written in a time of war, which begins with a very military gesture, and it's immediately answered by a kind of a pleading for peace. I think that's the struggle throughout the symphony. It's this between the desire for peace and the state of war. The second movement, which is full of, it, for me, is almost the kind of a portrait of the reality of war. I mean, there's real suffering and anguish. And wonderfully, the last movement, the last thing he writes symphonically, and the great triumph of this piece, is this extraordinarily complex counterpoint. And this idea that counterpoint was not something dry and intellectual, but was kind of the ultimate way of giving thanks to God. You say, you gave me a brain, you made us unlike the animals, and look what we, you know, we do the best we can with that ability to do you honor, so to speak.
Flying. Mm. Everybody flies. You also fly. But you also fly the aeroplane itself.
Has been known.
How did it start? I mean, what stage are you at? I mean, you have a pilot's license. Are you already flying commercial
airlines? I'm an unemployed airline pilot. That's where I am now. So
how did that start? I mean, where did the passion start? When did you decide to turn passion into doing something concrete about it?
That's quite recent, because I was always pretty obsessed, but from a distance. Wherever I was, I could call up local flying school and say, oh, you know, I'd love to have a trial lesson.
Right.
So I never went further than that. So in many places around the world, I would go in for an hour and you sit with an instructor and fly around, get to see a little bit of the local landscape. And the idea is for you just to get a kind of a feeling of what it is to control an airplane. And they hope that you'll get the bug and you'll say, I'd like to come back and do a license. I just never, ever had the time in one place to make that kind of commitment. But a few years ago, I knew that there was a very, very good school near to where I was living. And I thought, it's enough now. I really want to do it. And I felt confident enough And there was something the day that I had my first lesson that wasn't just a, you know, a kind of one-off dip your toe in. The day I'd started wasn't just the beauty of learning to fly the airplane, but of being a student right at the beginning of something again.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And obviously, musician, conductor, whatever, we're all students every day, and you learn, the challenges are never-ending. But it is a different thing to be right back at the beginning of something.
It's very refreshing.
Fantastic. And I'd always had this feeling that school and university, they all kind of came at the wrong time in life for me. I wanted to get out and be doing things. And then I always look back, I've been at Cambridge, and so many times I thought, I wish I could go back now. I would be so hungry for everything that they had to teach me. And at the time, I was just hungry to get out and work. And so maybe it's sated some of that desire. So I spent about a year doing my private license. Every time I had a couple of days off or a weekend, I would go down and I did it quite slowly because for me, it was still at that point something to do for pleasure. And I was enjoying just building up some experience and figuring out how it goes. And as with all the interesting things in life, the day you achieve the thing you always dreamt of achieving is the day you realize that it's nothing.
No, it's just the beginning.
Yeah, and I got my private license and the examiner said to me, this piece of paper allows you to start learning. That's great, what's next? Yeah. And of course, I'm just desperate to get an instrument rating. Your private license allows you to fly visually. You stay outside the clouds, you fly initially only at daytime, and you can only go where you can
see
what you're doing. But I mean, that's, you know, because the instrument rating is a longer course than the initial private license course.
Okay.
And in order to be allowed to do the instrument rating, you have to do a number of theoretical exams. So I started preparing for them, and I realized that I think I was eight different subjects. And I realized that if you do 14 subjects, that's what they call the airline transport pilot's license. And that allows you to do whatever you want to do afterwards.
Right.
So I thought, well, if I'm going to do eight, I might as well do 14. And it's all fascinating. So I did that and the instrument rating, and then I did my commercial license. And at that point, I thought, well, it's thrilling to be finally professionally qualified to do something, which I'd never been in my entire life. And I just didn't want to stop. And you realize at some point that something which always seemed completely unattainable, it's only a matter of putting one foot in front of the other. So as of last summer, I'm qualified as a co-pilot on the Airbus A320 family of aircraft. So now I'm a candidate. I applied for a job, and I'm in the middle of what they call the selection process. I've done some tests, and I have to do a few more. And I have a sabbatical year coming up.
Right.
And then I would very happily just arrange my life around that.
What do you think connections between flying and conducting?
Yeah.
There are concrete connections. One must benefit the other. Obviously, you're stimulated in a completely different way, but I mean, you have elements of control, psychological control, you have brain processing elements, massive amounts of information.
I think very similar. It's processing enormous amounts of information and prioritizing. Teamwork. Flight safety is a team activity.
Mm.
Aircraft today, you're not bombing around like the pioneers. you're in charge of something which is to a large extent autonomous,
right?
And you have to have an extremely good overview of what's going on. And
it's interesting, this autonomy. The concept of autonomy. I'm thinking of orchestras as well. In one respect, an orchestra can. And is sometimes, it's an autonomous organism.
Yeah.
But you as a conductor, you also have an overview and you have an effect. You dip into that autonomy when necessary. Would you say that's a fair analogy?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the question you always get asked by non-musicians. Well, but can't the orchestra play without the conductor?
Right.
So, well, of course they can. It's the wrong question.
Yeah.
Patrice Chéreau, with whom we did the Così fan tutte in Aix, he was asked the same question about a director and actors. And he said, if the actors don't act better because I'm there, then there's absolutely no point in me being here.
Right.
And so this is the same. The conductor's job, I think, as simply put as possible, is to effect positive change on what is there already. That's why people sometimes misunderstand. They think it must be incredibly easy to conduct the Berlin Philharmonic, much easier than conducting an amateur orchestra, because they're so good, it'll sound great anyway. And in that sense, if you're saying the challenge is just to produce an acceptable performance or a good performance, yeah, of course, it's extremely easy. I put my dog in front of the Berlin Philharmonic and they'll sound wonderful. I don't even have a dog. But if you say that the job of the conductor is to take what's there and to help everyone get that to a higher level, then of course, the better the orchestra is you're standing in front of, the harder it is to be a conductor.
Yeah.
Because there's absolutely no point in having a conductor if they have no positive effect on the result. I often speak about these things, of course, with fellow pilots, because there's always these questions about. I say, yes, the conductor is statistically highly unlikely to be the best musician in the room. But it's of no importance. And the captain is not necessarily the better pilot on the crew. There used to be a joke in Air France because there was a lady who worked in the cabin who was the double world champion of aerobatics. So they always say that Air France, the best pilot in the company, is a stewardess. The job of the conductor is not to be the smartest guy or to be the best musician. It's to have that ability and that skill to allow the others to do their job even better than they would
otherwise. That sounds like perfect orchestral conductor to me. Do you ever have a piece in your head when you're flying? Do you have a piece of music? Is it something you've been...
It's funny. I remember flying with a very good friend. We took off in Cannes. And we were going, we're going to Italy or Croatia or whatever. We were flying along the coast, the Mediterranean coast to France, and then northern Italy. And it's absolutely gorgeous. And it was a beautiful day. And he said, I'll take the radio. I'll do lookout. He said, put your headphones on. Choose your favorite piece of music. He said, and just feel the joy of flying the aeroplane, along to the music. Because for him, that's the dream. I didn't like it at all.
Oh, really?
It's like these are two things.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah, I fly to turn the music off.
There's
not a moment in the day and probably the night where there isn't something playing in my head. Right. Either just because I've got an earworm or because of the pleasure of listening to something in my head or because there's a problem. There's something I'm conducting 6 weeks' time and I haven't even consciously started thinking about it, but I know that there's a difficult transition and my brain's trying to figure out how I'm going to do it.
Are you saying flying is like relaxing? Because, I mean, it's like me when I go home after a really long tour and I want to hear that silence.
Mm. Well, I don't do it to relax.
No, obviously you can't.
But it's a different concentration. And I think it is the one time when I'm so focused on something that I can put the relentless music out of my head. And I think there is something that's an additional benefit.
Staying with flying, of course, you have to fly everywhere for your job. And we also, MCO, we fly everywhere for our job. It's not a luxury, it's just a necessity. I mean, we wouldn't be in Adelaide if we didn't all hop on an aeroplane here. Otherwise, we'd be on a boat and it would take, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 weeks. In the country I live in at the moment, Sweden, which is also a country that you work a lot with, being the artistic director of Swedish radio, we've had a little news story that's actually become quite big about an orchestra that has an environmental initiative. It's decided not to fly in conductors and soloists from the season 20. To 21. I don't know if you've heard about this story.
Which orchestra is it?
This is a Helsingborg Symphony Orchestra. It's a very well-meaning initiative that was taken up by the Guardian newspaper and then since went slightly viral on social media. People very much agreeing, and then, of course, people slightly disagreeing. The head of the cultural department of Helsingborg said they thought it was a slightly unfortunate way to make an environmental
statement. What are they going to do? They're just going to use people who are...
They're planning to use more local talent to persuade people, especially from Helsingborg is very close to Copenhagen. It's not so far away from Germany. So encouraged solar and conductors to come in by train more. Of course, it's very difficult to talk about it as a touring orchestra who travels all over the world, because there are certain practicalities that have to happen. But what's your perspective on
it? Well, you say obviously it's not a luxury, but in a sense, bringing the Mahler Chamber Orchestra to Adelaide is the definition of luxury. And if we're honest, and we should be honest, and we should pose ourselves these questions, there is no definitive answer to the question of whether everything we do is some kind of luxury. We play music partly because it's the thing we've discovered we're good at. Let's be honest. It's not, we don't just play music because we think, because we have lofty goals and we think it's important for society. We're musicians because as kids you try lots of things, and we're all people who discover that we are quite good at music. So that's what we stuck with. But obviously most of us have a very strong belief somehow that it's very important, even if we can't quite put our finger on it. And we believe that it has a huge role to play, connecting people and sharing and whatever. And those things seem to be very important today. And we face a lot of problems in the world today. And just to focus on two of them, one is environmental, and the other is kind of inward-looking nationalism and exclusion and whatever.
I suppose that's something I thought.
The story you tell kind of touches on both of those things at the same time.
Exactly. I mean, the first thing I thought when the statement was made from the orchestra manager, I thought, oh, cultural exchange, hang about. Where's that going to happen? I mean, artistic cultural exchange from a soloist or a conductor comes from, I don't know, Venezuela or Australia or whatever, that helps to make all your borders softer. I mean, if you're going to start to... It's nice to use local talent, but I suddenly got a bit scared that this kind of wall becomes more visible.
I don't want to pick on Sweden at all, because I think Sweden is... knowing Sweden very well, as having worked there for 12 years, I think Sweden is in many ways an exemplary country. Mm. But, I mean, we both know that the same ugly debates happen in Sweden that happen everywhere else, which are very often dressed up as we should support the local talent. And I'm not for a minute suggesting they think in Helsingborg.
Yeah, no.
But there is something something which can seem so so nice and positive on the outside can be hiding a very nasty kind of nationalist trend. I'm sure that they do this for the right reasons.
I know they do it for
we
the
have
right
in
reasons.
In the Swedish radio, we have an environmental committee, and they work on tour planning. So our musicians will have... We were on tour just November or whatever. And the decisions about when the orchestra flies between cities and when they take the train. So we had one day where they had one day off on a very heavy tour. And instead of having a rest, they were on the train for 10 and a half hours because the orchestra's environmental committee said, this is one where we can do better.
Do you think this is going to happen more and more in the future? I mean, I think of MCO, we also have an initiative where if the train journey is 6 hours, if the journey time by train would be 6 hours or less, then they choose that instead of a plane. Do you think this kind of initiative will be more visible?
I think it's absolutely brilliant that people are more and more aware and motivated. I think you should know, and I'm not a spokesman for the aviation industry, but I mean, you should know that there is also an enormous number of people who are massively motivated. And obviously, aviation is one of the big contributors to the problem.
But on the other side, it's something that has to happen. I mean,
and also the improvements are extraordinary, and they will continue to be. Yeah. It's in everybody's interest. Yeah. I really hope, and I'm not speaking as a conductor or as a pilot, just speaking as a person who lives here, I hope that there is this slight worry that individuals, and obviously all individuals have something to contribute and we can all make a huge difference, but I would think that the massive destruction of the environment, which is kind of the industrial scale thing,
Yeah.
I hope that we all don't teach our kids to turn off the taps and turn off the lights, and we'll do everything we can. But the kind of massive waste and destruction of resources that goes on in things that we can't see, that just carries on because it's much easier to make individuals feel guilty than industry.
Yeah. Daniel Harding, thank you very much.
What a nice way to finish.
Well, there you see how much I have to learn about interview technique. But the point comes through. The individual has a responsibility to the climate, but maybe even more so, huge multinational companies. Having said that, next time you go to buy the latest iPhone or this season's clothing or the newest gadget for your house or apartment, remember the power you hold should you decide to buy nothing and instead continue with what you already have. Companies won't produce what they can't sell, and your decision could make a difference for all areas of the human chain of consumption. Daniel is a rare kind of person, someone hungry not only for knowledge, but also the understanding behind it. Whatever he focuses on is never only about the how you do it, but also the why something is the way it is. Whether it's studying music, flying an aeroplane, dealing with a broken leg, or trying to understand what's really behind the climate crisis. As a performer, it's all too easy sometimes to enjoy what you do purely because you know you're really good at it. The thrill of the ride, the pleasure of the perfection. Like the computer gamer who regularly gets to the highest levels. It can trap you, and before you know it, you've lost your connection with what the composer is really actually trying to say, and which, by the way, is what the audience is also supposed to be getting. Not so with Daniel Harding. And not so with Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. He may have been the famous technical child prodigy genius that everyone remembers, but his music was so much more than that. Mozart was a master of social and political comment, and his acute awareness of what was happening in the world around him created remarkable, perfect snapshots of music for us to literally listen back through time and history and understand the tumultuous goings-on at the end of his century, the revolutionary 18th. Think of David Bowie's iconic song Space Oddity and what it said about the loneliness of the Cold War, technological race to the moon in the 1960s. Then listen to the opening of Mozart's Last Symphony, No. 41. You can hear the drums of the French Revolution, the war of the 1780s, coming ever closer and closer. I think of our present state of the world and wonder if maybe the grab for resources, metropolitanization of populations, rise of inequality, focus on nationalism, pervasive censorship of people's thoughts and actions, all of this would actually look rather familiar to Wolfgang Amadeus if he could be around today to comment. Next time, I'll hopefully have chatted to the Finnish violinist Pekka Kuusisto and Dutch stage director Jorinde Kiesmaet about their collaboration on Shapeshifters, MCO's answer to the question on all concert promoters' minds, how do you reinvent the classical concert experience? Don't forget, keep in touch and find out what we're up to and where we're performing in the world through our website, marlachamber.com, YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. The Between the Bars podcast team is Mark Parker, Matthias Meyer, and me, Yannick Donderlanger. A very special thanks to Takt Eins for recording our concerts. Till next time, from the Mahler Chamber Orchestra, keep listening.
Between the Bars.